This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Amateur Traveler, episode 349. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about ancient ruins, modern cities, and guinea pigs as we go to Peru. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have four news stories for you. In the first one, the thing you didn't want to hear if you have a fear of flying is that 4 out of 10 pilots in the United Kingdom have fallen asleep while flying an aircraft, a new survey revealed. This isn't broken down by how many of these were commercial pilots. They did also reveal that a third had woken up to find their co-pilot was asleep as well. In a completely unrelated story, United Airlines has had problems with crashes recently. Fortunately, they were computer crashes. They had a 2-hour outage recently that held up a total of 636 of the over 5,000 United flights that were scheduled. But we worry too much, according to Ryanair CEO. Ryanair CEO Michael O'Leary told the UK Telegraph that you don't really need seat belts. He's proposing standing room only section in the back of planes for budget travelers with no seat belts. You should be able to choose from a safety perspective. We're not talking about areas of huge turbulence around Europe, said O'Leary. You'd be fine with just a hang-on handle. European air safety laws currently don't allow this. And the last news story, you may have heard that Venice is underwater, and more so than usual. They usually get high tides this time of year, but this is the 6th highest tide level since 1872. Tourists have been seen wading through the streets of Venice in water sometimes up to their waist. They do have plans for new floodgates called Moses floodgates, but those have been postponed until 2014. For links to all four of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show Nick Stanziano, who is coming to us from Peru. He's the co-founder of SA Luxury Expeditions and a newly naturalized Peruvian citizen. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris.
Now, you don't sound like you may be originally Peruvian, as we say.
No, how'd you guess? I've moved around a bit in life, but I do have a second home in Northern California where I was raised, outside a town called Grass Valley. Although I was also born in Hawaii, in the Hawaiian Islands, in a place called Kealakekua, and I've called Peru home for about 8 years now, and both based out of Lima, but also spent significant time in Cusco, as well as living in the Sacred Valley.
And my take here is that it's Peru that took you into the tour business rather than the tour business that took you into Peru.
Yes, you could say that. I was raised in the restaurant business as a young man, so I'd always been in the service and hospitality realm. Mm-hmm. And a few years out of university, 24 years old, with my newly minted degree in Latin America, I decided to come to Peru specifically because growing up in Northern California, I was raised near the Sierra Nevadas. And I always loved to camp and hike in the mountains, and the Andes, and especially Machu Picchu, was a dream of mine as a child. And so I bought myself a one-way ticket, found myself in Cusco, Peru, and almost 8 years later, Peru has essentially, brought me into the travel industry, but I also feel it's sort of a natural evolution of mine in exploration and also just hospitality and getting to show folks a good time or help folks enjoy themselves and relax and get some perspective on things.
Okay. And for a lot of us, when we think about Peru, like you, we think about going down and seeing Machu Picchu. And yes. We're going to talk a little bit about that, but also you have some other alternatives for us. So what would you recommend? Say somebody has a 1 week or 2 week vacation in Peru, how would you spend it?
Of course, I'm a bit biased being a newly Peruvian citizen, but Peru has so much to see. And I really like to call, and this is sort of my own assessment of Peru, really the Mesopotamia of the Americas. Depending upon your opinion and assessment, civilization really did begin on the coast of Peru. Some of the earliest archaeological evidence of civilization started here on the Peruvian coast. They think that was due to a couple reasons. One being the Humboldt Current, which is a current that brings up cold water from the Antarctic that mixes with waters from the Pacific and creates very abundant fisheries. These abundant fisheries were leveraged by the use of things like domestic cotton on the coast of Peru that allowed the early civilizations here to leverage the fisheries and create a stable and abundant food supply and sort of develop into advanced civilizations earlier than other parts of the Americas. So Peru really has a very long, long history of civilization. One of the earliest civilizations, they think, not only in the Americas, but potentially the world, is called Corral, and that's about 3 hours north of Lima. And from Corral, which is dated about 5,000 years ago, to Machu Picchu, which they think was built in the sometime potentially in the 1400s, you have almost approximately 4,000 to 5,000 years of civilization. What has this created in Peru? It's created a number of incredible civilizations that have left some really impressive relics, both on the coast of Peru as well as in the Andes. Machu Picchu being obviously the most notorious and Machu Picchu being the most visited.
And you say the most visited, you had some numbers in terms of how many visits it gets in a year.
In a given year, we're seeing approximately 800,000 to 900,000 visitors. This year, 2012, has been a fairly brisk year for visitors, so we'll see when the year closes out, but we should be somewhere around that, so getting close to 1 million visitors. The park itself has a limit of visitors of 2,500 people per day. Hmm. Within that 2,500 people, you have also the, many people might have heard, the Classic Inca Trail. And the Classic Inca Trail has a limit of 500 people per day, which is 3 full days of hiking, and on the morning of the fourth day, you arrive into Machu Picchu through the sort of traditional entrance of what they call Intipunku, which means the sun gate, which is the main entrance into the sanctuary. If you don't do the four-day Inca Trail to Machu Picchu, the other main form to reach the park is by train, and the train will bring the rest of the visitors, most of the rest of the visitors to the park, given there's lots of alternative routes as well as the Classic Inca Trail, so you can hike and go by train, essentially.
Okay, so back to the original question, how would you recommend spending a week or 2 weeks?
Machu Picchu is a definite must, especially if you've never visited the park or the ancient Inca citadel there. We think that visiting Machu Picchu in a nice, comfortable pace, arriving to Cusco. Cusco is at a nearly 11,500 feet. So we recommend upon arrival, give yourself a good 2 days to 3 days to acclimatize. So you're really, your body is really in good shape and you're feeling energized before visiting Machu Picchu. We think that Machu Picchu itself deserves at minimum 1 full day, but many people prefer to spend 2 days. And especially if there's any sort of interest in things like photography or video, Machu Picchu could also be somewhere where you could visit for even longer. Machu Picchu itself is, how I like to explain it, is really sort of the cherry at the top of the sundae in the sense that Peru has a lot of very spectacular ruins both around Machu Picchu and in Cusco, which is the main city or the gateway to Machu Picchu. It's very recommended to see Machu Picchu, but really see Machu Picchu in conjunction with the other very critical sites that are part of the Inca Empire that was centered in the region of Cusco and Machu Picchu. The Incas connected their empire through a series of roads, and these roads linked a series of cities throughout the west coast of South America. And so Machu Picchu being the most sort of well-known and the most beautiful in a sense that it's aesthetically placed on top of the mountain. It's been very well-known. But near Machu Picchu, both in the city of Cusco, which is the main gateway into Machu Picchu, as well as the Sacred Valley, which any visitor to Machu Picchu will arrive to Cusco by plane, travel through the Sacred Valley either by train and or by vehicle, eventually arriving to Machu Picchu. So visiting Machu Picchu itself in Cusco, we really recommend 6 to 7 days. That's important to really get a good sense of what the Inca Empire was, what Cusco, their capital city, was really about, and how Machu Picchu fit into the empire, their achievements both architecturally and scientifically. And so we really believe Machu Picchu fits into this larger story of the Inca Empire. And so that takes 6 or 7 days, we think, to get a good understanding of for any visit. Another, if you have another 7 days visiting Peru, some significant tributaries of the Amazon River are within a 50-minute nonstop flight from Cusco. So the contrast in ecosystems from Machu Picchu in the Andes Mountains to the Amazon is just incredible. And for a vacation of 10 to 14 days, you can see Machu Picchu, which has been named man-made wonder of the world, and the Amazon, which has been recently named a natural wonder of the world. So we really think Machu Picchu and the Amazon are two big highlights, yet Peru has some incredible things to see, as well as one including Lake Titicaca, which is connected to Cusco by a beautiful train ride over the Andean Altiplano, and or bus or vehicle, as well as flight. And or some may have heard of the Colca Canyon, and the Colca Canyon's also in southern Peru outside of a city called Arequipa. And the Colca Canyon, depending on who's measuring, and there's many opinions out there, may be one of the deepest canyons in the world. And that's also in southern Peru. So southern Peru has some really incredible highlights to see, Lima being the capital city and currently the one principal international airport in the country. All visitors will have to come through Lima. And we really recommend, due to the typical flight itineraries, being that you typically arrive in the late evening to Lima from international destinations and you depart in the late evening, we really recommend for visitors, when you're departing Peru, you'll typically find yourself with a full day in Lima. And we think a full day of exploring Lima and its colonial city center is really great. The Lima's colonial city center goes back to 1532, immediately following the fall of the Inca Empire or the conquest of the Inca Empire. And Lima was really the seat for the Spanish vice royalty in South America. And the Lima's colonial city center has really preserved its, in my opinion, again, I'm biased here in Peru, but in my opinion, much better than other colonial city centers in South America. And there's some really neat things to see for a full day on your way home.
And you mentioned your bias, and that's not at all a problem. We bring people on who love the destination they're talking about as a rule. You actually ended up getting Peruvian citizenship. I'm guessing it's not just because of the architecture of the ancient Incans.
Yes. Well, there's a few reasons for that. Also, on my first visit as a single man almost 8 years ago.
Saw this one coming.
Yeah. I did meet my wife, who's Peruvian, and we have a 6-year-old daughter who's also Peruvian and American, or what I like to say, Californian sometimes. and so obviously that was a big motivator that my wife and daughter were Peruvians. Also too, I think I feel very much bi-national. I love where I come from and I very much call Northern California home, but it was very much a decision in the fact that Peru as a country, given all its faults and its challenges in development, it has given so much to me in not only at a personal level, but as a professional level. And it still continues to amaze me and it's done a lot to sort of make me who I am as a person. And so that was also involved in the decision to take the step, because there was no need essentially to go all the way to be a nationalized citizen. But it was very much sort of taking another level of commitment with the country. And that just, as you noted, it's not just in the architecture and how beautiful it is, but it's also a commitment to the country in helping it improve and being involved in the social debate and the intercourse politically here in the country. It's an important thing, and Peru is a very dynamic place right now, and it's very exciting to be part of its growth and part of its evolution as a country.
Okay. So when I come to Peru, which is definitely on my list to go, I'm going to go to Machu Picchu. I'm going to love it. But what's going to surprise me about Peru? What am I not expecting that I'm going to encounter?
I like to say the colors. Okay. The colors and the character. I think many people see Peru as Machu Picchu in the mountains, but the colors and the smells and the flavors, the native clothing, the spices, the color of the fruits, they're very vibrant. And I think it very much overwhelms your senses in many ways, both visually, both in smell, both in sound. It's very interactive. It's also very, potentially another surprise could be, it's also very rugged. What I like to say is a rugged country to travel in. The geography is very extreme here. They have mountains that go to 22,000 feet, and they have some of the most biodiverse and remote places on the planet in the Amazon. And so traveling here in Peru can be very rugged, both with considering the altitude and just in general modes of transportation. And so coming from very comfortable sort of cities elsewhere in the world, I think that's something that can be surprising for folks.
Okay. You also mentioned when we were pitching the show, because we'd already done a show on Peru and people can go back and listen to that. Good episode. But that there are other things to see. For instance, you mentioned the Sacred Valley, and that's, I know, where you live now and a particularly favorite spot of yours. What are the places that I haven't heard about?
Well, there's a very important ruin called Coilap in the northern Amazonian regions of Peru. One of the things that have protected Coilap, which is near a town called Chachapoyas, is due to its inaccessibility by air. It's really reached by bus, approximately about 10 hours from the closest city reached by air. And Coilap and Chachapoyas is spectacular for myself. My personal opinion, it reminds me a bit of Machu Picchu and Cusco, yet without the heavy crowds that you can see at times in Machu Picchu and Cusco. Some of the stonework and the ruins of the pre-Columbian civilizations that built it are at times as spectacular as Machu Picchu and some of the ruins around Cusco.
And I understand there's even new ruins that are being opened up all the time.
Very much so. The thing about the areas outside of Cusco and what they call the high jungle is that the jungle is very good at concealing ruins. The overgrowth takes over the stonework very quickly. So they are finding numerous ruins. One ruin that folks may have heard about out there, specifically in relation with Machu Picchu, is called Lac de Pata. And that's a ruin that some people have noted as the observatory of Machu Picchu, because it has incredible expansive views. And there's many folks out there in the scientific community and in the non-scientific community that are finding many alignments with the sun and the heavens with this place called Lac de Pata. There's many other ruins that are discovered, one being called Choqui Corral, which is sometimes called the sister city of Machu Picchu. Some people say it's upwards of 4 to 7 times the size of Machu Picchu. And obviously, people know it's there. About 10,000 people visit Choqui Corral annually. The problem is that it's so large in size is that there's just not enough resources to, one, clean the ruins, as well as keep the jungle back and maintain it. You're even seeing that with Machu Picchu as well. They're still discovering new terraces around Machu Picchu because of just the sheer size of the site.
Interesting. And then I want to get back to Sacred Valley, which you pitched me.
So the Sacred Valley is on the way to Machu Picchu. All visitors to Machu Picchu arrive to the city of Cusco. Sacred Valley, they call the Sacred Valley, or we've heard it at times as the Valley of the Kings. The Sacred Valley is a very abundant agricultural region that runs along the Urubamba River. Many of the towns and small communities in the Sacred Valley still practice, in many ways, the traditional Andean cultures of the region. Cusco is becoming a very large city, so any visitor to Machu Picchu that has it that takes the time to visit Sacred Valley, I think, won't be disappointed. Many of the fields and the communities are still being worked in the same fashion that they have for hundreds of years. One specific town, which is my favorite, one that I had an introduction to upon my arrival to Peru, is called Ollantaytambo. Ollantaytambo is also where the last train station is prior to Machu Picchu, so many folks travel through this village of Ollantaytambo. And Ollantaytambo sits along the Urubamba River and below a major Inca site called, with the same name, called Ollantaytambo, with massive rocks and a terraced mountain. The town of Ollantaytambo in the Sacred Valley has the original grid that it has had for hundreds of years since the Inca times, with its canals, walls, as well as the homes within this town are all original, going back to Inca times. And it's just one of the best sort of living museums of Inca culture, even though obviously things have changed. They do have internet, they have electricity, they have many restaurants, especially many tourists going through this town. It still really shares a lot of its culture as it has for 500 or more years.
And are there other highlights of the Sacred Valley we want to highlight before we move on?
Well, the Sacred Valley, many folks have heard about the town of Pizac. Pizac, like Ollantaytambo, has a very large Inca site above it as well, overlooking the city. And Pizac's known for a very popular indigenous market in this town square that can be visited for things like local textiles, local food items, as well as a lot of local art. And then also very near the Sacred Valley, or using the Sacred Valley as your departure point, is many more removed communities within a half day, a day, 2 days walk from the Sacred Valley by horseback or by foot. Some of these indigenous communities, unlike the towns that are in the valley floor, are much more removed, and you'll find that these Andean communities are practicing a much more sort of traditional lifestyle. Yet there is a lot of changes being made, a lot of changes happening with the increase of tourism to Machu Picchu in the past decade. But if anyone does have the chance to visit some of these communities, either in a pre-planned trek in the region, or even if some of the more adventurous folks out there can get a local map and make their way independently, it's very, very highly recommended to sort of get a glimpse into pre-Columbian life and culture. It's a really neat thing. It's something that made an impact upon me when I first arrived.
And so you say more traditional. So I'm picturing, and tell me how far off I'm getting here, we've still got some satellite dishes on the buildings, but not a lot of mechanized farming, and a slightly different diet than you'd run into in the rest of Peru.
Well, no, definitely no satellites on rooftops. Definitely no electricity.
Okay. All right.
within a half day to a full day walk from the Sacred Valley, you begin to encounter traditional, what I call communities. And when I say a community, it's really a collection of families, whether it's one family, two families, or three families sort of tucked on the hillside. Typically, many of these communities in the hills above the Sacred Valley, is at about 8,000 feet. Many of these communities live all the way up to 12,000 feet. They live in homes made of stone and thatch roof with no electricity. There's much more influence now with things like plastics, things like batteries, and obviously monetary resources are becoming ever more important. But when I say traditional lifestyle, these are communities that speak very little to no Spanish. They speak the traditional language of Quechua, which was the language of the Inca Empire as well. These folks do primarily agriculture, which is things like potato, quinoa, which is an Andean...
it's a grain, as I recall.
An Andean grain, exactly. Corn at not quite that high, but at lower levels, lower elevations, they do corn. And they have livestock, most notably alpaca and llama at those elevations as well. So these are folks that have been more or less removed from modern society for more than 500 years. We've seen a significant change with things like cell phones. Now these folks that live in stone huts and thatch roofs are a day's walk away from high-speed internet, hiking, going to the valley. Also, some of the main cities like towns, which are becoming small cities now, like Pizac or another one called Urubamba, have large markets. And so many of these traditional families that live in the hills will come down either on a weekly basis or a monthly basis to exchange things like potatoes or other goods that they've grown up on the hillside, and they exchange them for goods like sugar, salt, or things that they don't have access to. Mm-hmm. And obviously, so that exchange has an effect because they're bringing things, inorganic matters like plastics and batteries and things that just don't compost like things have for them for forever. And so the communities are changing. They're you can call it modernization, you can call it transformation. And so we are seeing some of that traditional culture changing, but it is still very much prevalent and alive in the Andes of Peru, and especially outside the Sacred Valley.
Okay. I'm glad I asked for clarification there, because I was not picturing that traditional when you were talking about that. Interesting.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Just as a shift here a little bit, so obviously we've talked a lot about going to Peru for things built not within the last 600 years, and yet Peru is obviously still a thriving society and culture these days. What would you go to see that was built in the last 10 years?
I would recommend anyone to the district of Barranco or Miraflores in the capital city of Lima. Lima, I guess most recent counts, is more than 8 million people. One of the great things about Lima is it's situated on the Pacific coast. The districts of Miraflores and Barranco are two very thriving districts, developing rapidly.
Miraflores, to see the flowers?
To see the flowers, and there are lots of flowers here in Miraflores in the park, some of the best parks in the city. And Barranco, which is next door to Miraflores, has become very much the bohemian center of the city, with some of the best art galleries, restaurants, a very thriving nightlife, and it's on the coast. Both districts, Miraflores and Barranco, are relatively safe in the sense that safe as most major cities in the U.S., and they have had a lot of development, not just in construction and sort of infrastructure, but also in awareness of many issues in the country. And it's very much a center, intellectual center of the country as well.
Huh. You deal with tourists all the time. They've got with them their brat guy, their Lonely Planet guy, their whatever guidebook with them. What do the guidebooks tell them to see that you think is just a waste of time?
Well, I do think Lima as a city has gotten a much worse reputation than it should have. It's a city of 8 million people, and it's obviously at first glance, especially upon arrival at the airport, it can be sort of a very intrusive experience because there are lots of horns and traffic. But I believe Lima is a beautiful, beautiful place. During university, I lived in the city of Florence in Italy. I've lived in many other beautiful cities in the world. And I think Lima, in the right places of the city, is as beautiful as any of them. It's just how you see it. And so if it's done right and you're with the right guest, whether they're friends of yours that live in Lima or with a tour company, Lima can be a very neat place to see, both culturally and in its gastronomy, which is one of the best cities, I think, in the world for gastronomy.
And we talk about gastronomy. What should I eat when I'm in Lima? Or what should I eat when I'm in Peru?
Well, the national dish here in Peru is called ceviche, and similar to the ceviche that you find in other Latin American countries, in the fact that it's typically raw fish and or shellfish that's marinated in basically fresh lime or cooked in fresh lime. Absolutely fantastic here on the Peruvian coast. One of the things about Peru's geography and how extreme it is that the food and the cultures change. And so in the Andes, you'll find a very much a different type of cuisine. One of the more sort of notorious and traditional dishes in the Andes is cuy or guinea pig, which is a traditional dish going back to the Incas. It's very, very popular. And even here in Peru, I always like to recommend in the city here in Miraflores and Barranco has some wonderful, wonderful restaurants with chefs that are truly world class, and sort of this new breed of Peruvian chefs and Peruvian gastronomy has really brought sort of fusion of Peruvian spices and flavors with sort of international cuisine, and that's really not to be missed. There's a few restaurants specifically here in Lima that I think you can get a comparable meal to some of the best restaurants in Los Angeles and San Francisco, but at about a fifth of the cost. And so,
and would you care to name which restaurants you're thinking of?
Well, my personal favorite here in Lima is called Rafael's. It's a bit of a bistro atmosphere, but it's a fantastic restaurant here in Miraflores. And there's been here for more than 10 years in Miraflores. And there's a newcomer that's become a new favorite of mine as well called Central. And that's also here in Miraflores. And that's from a chef that has become one of Peru's top chefs as well. And that's a favorite of mine. Both restaurants do an excellent job of sort of bringing the traditional flavors and colors of Peru and putting sort of their own touch on it, which I sometimes call Nouveau Andean cuisine or Nouveau Peruvian cuisine, and it's spectacular.
Now, we asked about food. You mentioned the guinea pig, and you kind of danced right over that. You said it was notorious. You didn't say you like it, you don't like it. It sounded like I got the impression it was try it once, but there are better dishes.
I personally, if it's done right, I'm a big fan of cooey or guinea pig.
Okay.
I've had very good guinea pig in very traditional communities tucked away in the Andes. And at the same time, I've had very nouveau guinea pig here in the restaurants of Miraflores. That is guinea pig that has been deboned and with its guinea pig confit on top of organic carrots and Andean potatoes. So I've had it both in a plate that looks like it's been done by the most beautiful, best chef in the world. And I've had cuy been done by a woman in a traditional outfit cooked on top of her brick stove tucked away in the Andes. Both are good. Both have its benefits. But one thing I will say, if you are having cuy in the Andes in a more traditional atmosphere, you will want to watch out because of if it's not cooked right, obviously there can be some issues with the digestion, if you can get me on that. So, but I recommend it. I think anyone to Peru, if they have a chance, to try cuy.
And that sort of leads us into warnings you would give for going to Peru. You hinted at altitude.
Yes. Altitude, because Cusco is such a visited place here in Peru, and it is 11,500 feet, it's always recommended with the altitude is that on arrival, it's very important, and it's one of my big recommendations, is try not to have a packed itinerary. The city of Cusco is very quaint. It's very walkable. It's very accessible. So we really recommend the first day, you really want to keep hydrated. You probably don't want to overindulge in things like alcohol because it can dehydrate you, and hydration helps with the altitude. There's also some prescribed medications that you can take. One well-known is called Diamox. That is a preventative medicine for altitude. But the altitude is something not to be afraid of, but because many people, hundreds of thousands of people visit Cusco every year and are just fine. But it does require about 24 to 48 hours of kind of go at your own pace, go at a pace that you feel comfortable and watch out for the things like headaches and lethargy that are some sort of key signs of altitude.
When you mentioned the city being a very walkable city, the last time I was up at 11,000 feet, well, I guess the first time I was up at 11,000 feet, a Trail Ridge Road in Colorado, I recall going on a 1/4 mile hike, and it seemed much, much longer.
Yeah.
Basically, it was walk 50 feet and pant. So easy walkable city, considering the altitude.
I tend to think it is. It's easily walkable. Something do keep in mind, though. Many, many folks, many tours are done the first afternoon upon arrival in Cusco.
Oh, gosh, wow.
And that first afternoon, not only are crowds very, very heavy because many folks are arriving to Cusco and moving on either into the Sacred Valley or Machu Picchu on day two. But really taking that first afternoon, the city square, what they call the Plaza de Armas, is a beautiful plaza with some fantastic cafes with balconies. And I always recommend, and it's a favorite thing to do of mine, is to really relax on one of the balconies, enjoy what they call mate de coca, which is actually coca leaf tea. Coca leaf is legal here in Peru, especially in the Andes, and you put coca leaf with hot water and some sugar, and it's called mate de coca. It's fantastic, and it's also a traditional remedy for altitude. So relax one of the balconies in the Plaza de Armas that first afternoon with the sun going down and sort of taking in the sights and the smells and the feel of the city, but yet in a bit more relaxed fashion. I think it can't be beat, and it's highly recommended. And then save your heavy activity for day two and three.
You're standing at the prettiest spot in Peru. Where are you standing? What are you looking at? And let's leave your wife out of this. Okay.
Well, it's so hard. Peru is a country of contrasts, and there's three main contrasts in this country. And one is the Pacific coastline that stretches for thousands of miles. The other is the Amazon rainforest, which is immense. And the other is the Andes Mountains and the Andean Altiplano that goes all the way from northern Chile to southern Colombia. So I'm going to cheat here, but I'm going to give three spots in each of those sort of ecosystems. Okay. Sunset in Miraflores overlooking the Pacific Ocean is beautiful. Okay. It is absolutely fantastic. The air is clean. The water is relatively clean, and it's just a wonderful place to be. In the Andes, I would have to say, on top of the mountain overlooking Machu Picchu called Huayna Picchu. It's the tall pointed mountain behind Machu Picchu that they only allow 400 people per day, and it's a series of terraces and stone walkways built by the Incas that gets you up to this pencil tip summit, and that summit is essentially enough room for five or less people, and from that vantage point has one of the most beautiful views of Machu Picchu in the Peruvian Andes. That's just spectacular. Actually, we're going to go back. I have to say, I'm going to have to change my vote. My vote is on top of Huayna Picchu, overlooking Machu Picchu.
Okay.
It's a place that really, not only is it aesthetically beautiful, but it can be very spiritual in a sense that you really take in the immensity of what Machu Picchu is, and you're able to take in the immensity and how Machu Picchu is really connected to the mountains and to the natural landscape. And it's really a sight to be seen, and it really helps put Machu Picchu in a different perspective.
One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Peru.
In Lima, up until recently, we've just gotten a subway system and a public bus system. But up until prior to 2 years ago, there was no public transportation system in the city. And that transportation system, which still today is very prominent, is done by something called combis. And combis are small minivans. And these minivans come with two people that run the van. One's a driver, and the other one works at the door and essentially yells out the window, soliciting passengers. And these combis are have no rules of the road. Not only do they have no rules of the road, but they also battle each other for passengers throughout the city of Lima. And while it does create quite a traffic snarl, they have a very well-known sort of call, almost like a turkey call if you were hunting turkeys, but it's essentially a call that calls out passengers. And
now, you were thinking about doing that call for us right there for a second, but you thought better of it.
Yeah, well, subir is a verb in Spanish to get on or mm-hmm. to get ascend, on, essentially. Right. So sube is sort of the infinitive form of that, or not the infinitive form, but it's the form in which they do. So they
imperative.
Go sube, 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 and that call is for passengers to know that the combi is going to stop, and the combis can tend to have no limit in the amount of passengers they carry. So if you've seen the pictures of how many people you can fit in a Volkswagen Bug, they can't hold anything to a combi in Lima.
I've got two more traditional questions that I'll ask it in a minute here. But before I do, what else would you like people to know about coming to Peru?
I think the very important thing is that Peru, as we spoke a bit about Miraflores and Barranco, Peru has a very modern side to it. I think sometimes folks can have an idea that Peru is only a sort of an...
The last time it changed was the 1400s?
Yeah, exactly. And Peru has very modern sections of the country, and it has places like some folks traveling here may not want to hear it, but it's very true. It has things like Starbucks, and it has things like McDonald's, and it has things like Chili's and Fridays and Cineplexes and big universities and major businesses. And this development and growth, if it's done responsibly in Peru, is a positive thing for this country. And so I think also it's important that people get a really balanced view of what Peru is. Peru is a country that's growing at almost 7% a year. And so it's a very much an emerging economy as well financially in South America. And so to get a real balanced sense of Peru, that it's just not the picture, standard picture of the traditional Andean person in the Andes or the person in the rainforest with a feather and a bow and arrow, but it's very modern, very progressive people that live here in the city that are working very hard to help turn Peru into a very functional and very positive country.
Excellent. Last two questions. You really know you're in Peru when what?
You really know you're in Peru when, along with the luggage and the bicycles on the roof of the bus, they've also put the livestock.
And if you had to summarize Peru in three words, what three words would you use?
Wondrous.
Yeah.
Contrasting.
Mm-hmm.
And beautiful.
Excellent. Now, where can people read more about your travels and your travels in Peru, and how can they learn more about SA Luxury Expeditions?
Probably the best place is at our website, saluxuryexpeditions.com. We also have a very active travel blog as well that you can see articles written by our team. We're sort of a funny hodgepodge of international folks in here in Peru and around the world that just very much believe in the country and what it is, and kind of have made Peru home. And we have many articles written from us directly, and all the contact information's there. But whether you decide to travel to Peru with a travel company like ourselves, we highly recommend it as a place to explore, both young and old, and whether independently or organized, as I mentioned, with a travel company. It's a spectacular country, and it's a country that's ever-changing. And we think it's going to be a very sought-after place with the more awareness that it gets around the world.
Excellent. Our guest again has been Nick Stanziano. Nick, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing with us your obvious love of Peru.
Great. Thanks, Chris.
In news of the community, I got a comment this week on the website said, I'm disturbed that you would promote tourism to Uganda when it is poised to institute the most draconian laws against homosexuals on the planet. Not only would gay people be subject to the death penalty, but those who simply do not report gay people or even rent them an apartment would be subject to imprisonment. Western governments are prepared to cut aid funding if the law goes into effect. And honestly, I did not know that that was true. But here's the controversial part. I probably still would have done this show. And the reason for that is because, honestly, I'm one of those people who believes that travel facilitates communication and exchange of ideas. So I was one of those people who favored travel to South Africa during apartheid. I was one of those people who favored travel to the Eastern Bloc countries during the Cold War. So I may be wrong, but at least I am consistent. And in somewhat more upbeat news, at first I did not think this episode would come out this week because my editor got busy. And so I had announced on the Facebook group, in fact, that we were going to miss this week and this show was going to come out the 1st of December. And Daniel made my day when he said, "Where will I get my fix? I might have to go down to the train station and accost strangers. Excuse me, mate. You couldn't spare one travel story, could you? Even one little one would do. It can even be about Bali. Please?" Daniel, thanks for the laugh. These days, I could certainly use all that I can get. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. The link for this episode will be in your lyrics of this episode. You can also follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. And if you are willing to follow me on Twitter, if you go to Amateur Traveler, there's a contest. If you listen right after this comes out, you can enter a contest by following me on Twitter and retweeting that you can win a free hotel night stay at the Radisson. And as always, thanks so much for listening.